Hi, I'm Sanjay, and I'm a serial entrepreneur for the kicks, and I also invest in startups.
And I'm Shannon, a recent college grad working on building my first company.
And this is Startup Days,
the show where we take a behind-the-lens look at starting and growing a company from the perspective of founders and investors. Hey, Startup Days listeners, Shannon here. This week's guest is actually the host of the Startup Days podcast, Sanjay Parekh. Back in the late 90s, Sanjay invented IP location technology, which led to his first startup, Digital Envoy. Since then, he's founded numerous companies and shared his knowledge to further the community through his work with Startup Riot and Prototype Prime, where we record this podcast from. Despite his intimidating resume, Sanjay is one of the easiest people to talk to, and he shares a lot of tips that contributed to his success in the next 30 minutes. Also, remember to tweet us at Startup Days Pod or DM us at Startup Days on Instagram if you have startup questions or any random questions that you would like to hear us talk about on the show. Now, here's Sanjay. You're from Atlanta, right?
Actually, I'm from Kentucky. I was born and raised in Kentucky. Moved down here after junior high. That was back in the days when we still had junior high, so ninth grade. Did 2 years there. I was lucky enough to get early admission into Georgia Tech, so I skipped my senior year of high school. Did 4.5 years at Georgia Tech because we never graduated in 4 years. I don't think I know very many people that have graduated in 4 years. I did my 4.5 years and then dutifully got a job because that's what we were kind of educated and told back in those days. That's what happens. You go to Georgia Tech and you go get an engineering job. Ended up working for that company who's still around, and I still love the place, Aeris, now known as Aeris Interactive. So I was early there. I was an electrical engineer at Georgia Tech, never did any engineering as an adult after leaving Georgia Tech. I meet so many engineers from tech, and so many of us have that same story that we learn something and then we never do that.
Because you're really taught to problem solve, and you can apply that in so many different ways.
Right, so. Exactly. Yeah. That's why so many engineers, especially from Georgia Tech, as well as other schools, get sucked into financial services and things like that. And thinking about kind of bigger problems like that. So anyways, I spent time at Aeris, ended up traveling around the world, lived in Tokyo for 3 months.
Wow.
Had a great time. I still speak no Japanese, but I'm a big fan and somewhat still remain to be a big fan of sumo wrestling.
Okay.
and only for the fact that every other month there would be a basho, which is a 2-week competition of the top rank of sumo wrestling. And they'd broadcast it in Japanese and in English.
Nice.
And back then, we actually had the first non-Japanese Yokozuna. His name was Akebono. And Akebono was an American. He was a Hawaiian. So I even had somebody to cheer on on top of that, right? It was in English and I had somebody to cheer on. So
nice.
I became a fan of sumo wrestling from my time in Japan.
Very cool. Is there anything that you can get? Like, can you get a jersey for sumo wrestling or any type of gear to support your player?
They don't really do that. There's no jerseys in sumo wrestling. Yeah, I don't know. I never actually got to go to a match.
To a live match?
Yeah, I always watched it on TV. I hope one of these days I can go.
Yeah, that's something that you should put on your bucket list. Go back and see a live sumo match.
Absolutely on my bucket list. It's funny, a couple of years ago, they flew all the sumo wrestlers to Vegas for doing a bout there.
Yeah.
And they made sure all the wrestlers, they split them up into two different planes so that if something happened, they didn't lose all of their wrestlers in one accident.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably also good for the weight distribution, too, I think.
Yeah, I would think so.
So, anyway, so I spent time in Japan, spent time across the U.S. as well as in Europe deploying those systems. And then back in 99, it was actually March 17th, 99, if we want to be exact, I happened to be at home. And this was the go-go days of the internet. It was the dot-com bubble days. I hit the FedEx and IKEA websites. Mm-hmm. So the first thing those two websites asked you before they showed you any content was what country you're in. And I thought that was just a dumb thing for them to do. And thinking about it, knowing that I spoke English, it was an easy question to answer. But if you didn't speak English, how do you answer those questions about what country you're in? So I was thinking about those folks, and I said, you know, I think there's a better way to do this. We should be able to automatically determine where somebody is geographically on the internet so that we can just push them to the content that's relevant to them and not show them stuff that doesn't make any sense for them. So basically that night I architected the solution to that problem, which is IP location. So that led to the next day I went into Aeris, talked to the general counsel of Aeris, who had become a friend over the last few months, and said, you know, I've got this idea and maybe this is something to do as a startup. And he said, well, it's either impossible to do or somebody else is doing it, because it just sounds too obvious that it's not already
done. That no one's done it already.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we talked to some his brother and some other folks out on the West Coast who were kind of internet guys. Mm-hmm. And we told them the idea, and they said, you know, we think it's possible to do it. Mm-hmm. We don't know anybody else that's doing it, mm-hmm. And you should do it. And so that kind of started it. So we ended up raising.
So this happened really quick, it seems like.
March 17th was the idea. March 18th was or 18th or 19th, we kind of got the validation. And then within about a week of that, we talked to a friend of the general counsel's, who was then my co-founder, who actually still works at the company to this day, you know, almost 20 years later. And we talked to a friend of his, and that friend put in $100,000. We had built nothing. Yeah. But back in those days, with just an idea, you could get away with raising money.
Yeah, let's talk about what startup culture was kind of like back then, because it was sort of the beginning stages of it, and now it's been glamorized into TV shows, right. Movies, everything. But what was it like back then?
Yeah, it wasn't like this at all, quite honestly. So I spent most of '99 working on the side. We had another co-founder who was out of the finance group come and join us as well. We went to meetings at CNN and places like that and pitched the idea. And we kind of did customer discovery, but we didn't call it that. And we didn't really recognize it as that. And at the end of '99, we basically started a raise of an angel round of $1 million was our goal. We ended up with $1.5 million. But when I announced in 2000, the first working day is when I announced I was going to leave. I told my boss. And it was interesting because he took me out to lunch right away, didn't let anybody know, basically trying to figure out a way if they could keep me, which between you and me and everybody that's listening, I find that a little insulting. Like, if you know I'm worth more money, you should be paying me more.
You should have already done that. Like, it's too little, too late situation.
Yeah. So, you know, if anybody out there ever hires me for anything and then realizes they're underpaying me and then I leave and then don't try to do that, because it's not going to work with me, because it's too late at that point. And I think you should never do that with any employee. You should recognize their value. And if you think they should be paid more, you should pay more. And if they decide to leave, you should say, well, okay, that's just what it is. I paid you as much as I could. So that happened. And as I'm leaving, all of the employees that I know, and this was a small company at the time, we were only maybe about 200 people at this point. And since I was so early, I'd known a lot of them. They were like, oh, what are you going to do? And this, that, and the other. And I was kind of cagey about it. I didn't tell them the name or the exact idea. And they're like, doesn't sound like a good plan. And they were kind of just raining on the parade. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to just make a go out of it and see what happens. But it wasn't the accepted thing that it is now. I mean, even my parents were kind of like, what are you doing? You have a good job. We don't really understand. And maybe parents are still like this.
Yeah, I think parents are still like this.
And I think as a parent, I could maybe understand that as well. But
right. I mean, the odds are against you, right? So it makes sense for your parents or anyone to tell you that.
Absolutely.
Those are just the facts.
Right.
But you have to take that risk sometimes.
But and I think the other side of it is that it is such a learning experience as a founder. You're going to do so many things that you would never be able to do. If I was still working for Aeris, I mean, there's still people that I worked with there, first job out of college, they're still there. And I just look at how different our experiences in life have been. I have been able to do just some unimaginable things that there would never have happened if I was still sitting in a cube or an office working for some large corporation.
Yeah. And just stepping outside of that defined role makes you kind of appreciate the things that other people do that you never would have been experienced with.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you kind of understand what everybody's place is in it because you had to do all the jobs before, right? And you appreciate it when other people are willing to do the jobs that you may not necessarily want to do.
So when you stepped away, how far were you with this new company?
Not far.
Okay, you just had raised the money. Had the technology been developed at that point?
It was mostly like I had written a lot of it, so it was poorly done. It really needed to be rewritten. And what was interesting, so when I announced that I was leaving, I did not try to get any more engineers or anything from that company. I had a couple of people approach me, say, hey, we might want to come too. This sounds interesting. And so we picked up a couple of folks from that previous company. The thing that held folks back, and so in retrospect, it's like, man, did I make that? No, I made the right choice. If I'd waited a couple of months, there was a big bonus payout. And I probably left a few tens of thousands of dollars on the table by not sticking around. And that was the other thing that drove people like, what are you doing? You're leaving now? Like, if you just wait 2 months, you'll get a bunch of money and then you could leave. And my gut was like, the time was right, right? We saw those things kind of aligning. We saw the traction happening. It felt like if we waited, we would fall further and further behind. There's an opportunity for a competitor to come up and beat us. And in fact, about a year after we started, so kind of later in 2000, there was a competitor that came up, much better funded than we ever were. We only raised $12 million lifetime for the company. This competitor raised, I think, about $40 million on the West Coast. I don't know what they sold for eventually, but I have heard that they sold for less than the amount of money that they raised. So they sold for less than $40 million. We sold for more than what we raised. So ours was a positive exit. It doesn't sound like theirs was a positive exit. And so some of that I attribute to the fact that we were early, but I think it also attributes to the fact that we were a lot friendlier to people. We're from
that
the South.
Southern hospitality.
Exactly. I'm born and raised in the South. I'll always be in the South. So that's kind of what it was like in terms of also of culture here in Atlanta. Like, there were not a lot of tech startups here.
Yeah.
I tried to get out and meet folks and stuff. There were not folks like me.
It can be lonely in those beginning days if you don't have people to bounce ideas off of.
Yeah. It can be very lonely. And I always say this to founders is that, look, you know, you're going to have highs that are high and lows that are so low. Mm-hmm. It's easy to find people to party with you when their highs are happening. Everybody wants to be there when the highs are happening. It's when the lows happen. That's the important part. And a lot of times that's why it's important to have a founding team and not be a sole founder, because, man, those lows stink and nobody wants to be around when those happen. But your co-founders, they have to be there, mm-hmm. right? Because you're all going through it together.
Yep.
And that's why it's important, especially if you're a first-time founder. I think it's important to have a founding team.
Yep. So you step away from the company. You guys had a successful exit. What happened in between there to get to the exit point?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of things that happened. There was, you know, I often say that there's founders and entrepreneurs that have had to worry about payroll and those that have not yet had to worry about payroll. That's the difference there. And so if you're lucky enough to be in the camp that have not yet, you should know that it's coming at some point. I've had to worry about payroll. There was a point in time where we were probably a couple of weeks out from closing down the business because we didn't have enough money. This was in 2001.
Okay.
The co-founding team, we all took live checks multiple times for our payroll because we weren't sure that there was enough money in the bank to cover payroll. And we felt it was more important for all of the employees to make sure their checks cleared instead of our checks. And then once all that happened and we were like, okay, there's still enough money in the bank. Okay, now we'll deposit our checks. So it was this weird, you know, talking about those lows and those highs. That was the lows that happened just before we closed a $10.5 million round. It's just
that's
nuts,
insane. Yeah.
Right? I mean, and the founders, we did not have the bankroll to be able to fund the company for months on end. We just, you know, we were all first-time founders. None of us had ever started a company before. We were the blind leading the blind. We didn't know anything. You know, one time a guy from the Better Business Bureau came in to sign us up, and this was probably only a month or two after we opened our office in 2000, and was signing us up, and it was free. And he said, okay, so, you know, where's your business license? And we all kind of looked at each other going, it's probably in the mail. We'll get you that number later.
Yeah.
And then we were like, wait, we need a business license?
Yeah.
So that day we had our CFO, who's one of our co-founders, go straight to City Hall and get us a business license, because nobody tells you that stuff,
no,
right?
No.
Like, you don't know, like, I don't have a store that anybody's coming to. Why do I need a business license? But you need a business license.
Yeah.
Everybody needs a business license.
Yeah,
if you've
listeners,
got a company.
If you want to start a company, go get that business license.
Get a business. You got to incorporate first and
yep.
then get a business license.
Yep.
You know, there's all kinds of random things that happened along the way. When we were closing that $10.5 million round, that was 10 months of pitching for me. I pitched a little over 200 VCs to close
wow.
that round.
Wow.
And
did you have multiple offers and choose one, or did you only have one option and that's
yeah.
what you guys went with?
So it was, I'll tell you, it was a little bit of a crazy story. Beginning of 2001, we had two term sheets. And we ended up signing one of them, and we went into due diligence. So the normal way that this works is once you go into due diligence, they start looking at all the legal stuff and, you know, making sure that you've disclosed everything and that, you know, the founders are not felons, you know, like all that kind of stuff. They start looking at all of that stuff to make sure that it's a proper investment. So about a month and a half into due diligence, the firm calls us up and says, look, we haven't found anything wrong with your company. we just don't have any more money. And so we can't do this investment. And as you know, the most important thing in that transaction is money for that to all work. And I'm sure it was a hard call for them. It was a hard call for us, too. And so we all kind of looked at each other and said, well, got to suck it up. It was about a half an hour pity party. And then we just got back to getting on the phone. So we started calling the people that we said no to. One of those firms said, well, we've moved on, and they didn't want to have anything to do with us. So we basically started from scratch again. And in the end of it, it was probably the best thing that could have happened to us. That first term sheet was probably for $3 to $5 million. Okay. This new term sheet that we ended up getting, we again got two term sheets and we signed one. It started as a $3 to $5 million term sheet. But AOL Time Warner Ventures came in, and because of that, everybody lost their minds. And so we had VCs just throwing money in at this point. So our round went 3 to 5, 5 to 7, 7 to 9, and we ended at $10.5 million.
Oh my gosh.
And for us, we were kind of like, well, we didn't know what we would even do with $10.5 million.
Yeah.
We were like, well, we're just going to take it all and just, you know, we'll sit on it if we have to, whatever. And that was July 2001. Few months later, 9/11 happened.
Right.
And here in Atlanta, no startup got funded for probably the better part of a year.
Wow.
Sales slowed. Everything went down. And if we hadn't had all that overage of money, it would have been a hard time for us.
Yeah.
But because we had all that excess capital, and when we sold the company, I think we still had about $1 million left in the bank from that original round. We didn't have to ever worry about it again. We just went on as business as usual. If sales happened, sales happened. If not, we were just going to keep cranking. And we knew the market would come around, and eventually it did. So I ended up leaving the company in my operating role in 2005.
Okay.
I needed a break from working.
Yeah.
So I took a year off and did a one-year MBA at Emory.
Okay.
And I stayed on the board. Unfortunately, midway through 07, Digital Envoy, my first startup, sold.
Did you guys know that was coming for a while?
There had been some kind of rumblings before,
okay,
but nobody to that serious level,
yep,
right? So the seriousness happened probably in the final like couple of months just before the sale. There were a couple of suitors, and you know, they were jockeying back and forth, and then we ended up going with one. And very fortunate for that exit, and it freed me up from having to worry at least immediately about what I was going to do next. And then that opened me up to be able to do Startup Riot the next year, because I really wanted to give back and help out other entrepreneurs, because I was so lucky and that I wanted to pay that luck forward a little bit to other entrepreneurs.
So what exactly was Startup Riot?
Originally it was 50 startups. It eventually became 30 startups to do 3-minute, 4-slide presentations all throughout the day in a conference style event. But I did things a little bit differently because, you know, I've always been focused on how can we make things better. So one of the things I've always found with conferences, and no disrespect to these folks, but they are swamped by service providers,
yep,
lawyers, accountants, recruiters, consultants, all those kinds of folks. And we love y'all, but we really need to focus on the folks that are going to help us, especially when we're early stage startups. And so I decided to ban all of those people from the event unless they were a sponsor of the event.
Did you get any pushback from that?
Oh, yeah, tons. There are still to this day people that hate me for the fact that I kept them out of this event. And honestly, like, you know, I care, but I don't care,
right,
at the end of the day, because
right,
the people that I care about are the entrepreneurs, the founders, and the investors,
yeah,
and the corporate folks that I'm trying to get to this event to help those founders. At the end of the day, I only care about the founders. I need all those other people to help the founders.
Right.
Right. So I my goal was to get the people in the room that would help the founders. We did it as a cheap event. It was, I think it was like $20 to $70.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For an all day conference. Yeah. We wouldn't feed people lunch. it was interesting. The first year I did this, and I was expecting people to go to lunch together, and people, like, you know, introvert founders, they'd get their lunch and then just sit by themselves in a corner eating their lunch. And I was like, okay, well, that stinks. So the next year, what I did was I color coded everybody's badges. So they had one of four colors, red, green, blue, yellow. And this actually caused some problems. And I'll tell you those problems in a second. But the goal of those colors was, okay, it's lunchtime now. You've got to go find three other colors. So if you're a red, you've got to go find a blue, green, and a yellow to go to lunch with. You can't go by yourself. You've got to find three other people and go as a group to lunch. And eventually we started getting food trucks and things like that so people could spend as much or as little as they wanted. The interesting side note of what happened there was people assumed and assigned value to those colors, even though they were entirely random. So I had founders that were presenting that assumed that the green meant money. And those were the investors. So they would linger on people that were in the green and then afterwards say, dude, I was talking to this person, but there was an investor that I didn't know and whatever. And so I never put...
you're like, you're way overthinking it. This is just to get everybody. You to go to lunch and talk to everyone.
Well, so the badges just had their name with no company affiliations. Because my theory was, I have picked all these people. I've looked at every single person's LinkedIn and screened them and made sure that they are a legitimate person to be in the room. And only then do they get in. And so if you trust me, if you're coming to this event, you should meet everybody and anybody that's there. They're all useful.
And even focus on the person over the organization.
Exactly. Yep. Focus on how can you help them or how can they help you, even if they're not somebody that's going to invest. So that ran for a good number of years. We ran it for a couple of years in Seattle, as well as about 6, 7, 8 years here in Atlanta. And it was great. And it's funny and it's sad, too, in some ways that just the other day somebody said, I miss the old days when Sanjay used to run Startup Riot. And I've shut it down. And the motivation for that is that there's a lot of events now here in Atlanta, and there's a lot of startup events and events for founders, not just in Atlanta, but across the U.S. and internationally. And I didn't feel like I was doing anything different anymore.
Right. At the beginning, it was. I think that's kind of the trend that I'm getting from talking to you is you're always on the front end of things before they happen, and then it gets totally infiltrated.
It's much more interesting to me to do something that's different and useful and helpful and is making an impact. The minute I'm not making an impact, I'm going to lose interest really, really quickly, and it's time to move on to something else. That's why, you know, here at Prototype Prime, we've done things differently, right? We've engaged with artists, and we have lots of art. People are wowed by the art. But really, the art just tells the story of who we are and what we do. And it keeps the people that are here kind of excited and engaged, rather than coming into a building and it's all white walls and kind of boring hotel art or something like that. Like, that's not who we are. That's not my personality. I don't want to come into a place like that. So why would I subject other people to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just a place that you can walk into and instantly be happy to be there and be working at. So yeah.
I hope it puts a smile on people's faces when they walk in.
All right. So what's next for you?
So I'm actually working on another new startup.
Okay. Can you talk about that at all, or is it kind of secret?
It's early-ish. Okay. It's in the email space. So I'm looking to do things that are impactful. Again, my goal is to do something that impacts a lot of people and has long-lasting effects. So we're a couple of co-founders right now. We're about to add on a third co-founder, it sounds like. So hopefully we'll get cranking soon. But, you know, where I see things going, it's amazing to just look back on 20 years and how much progress we've made. You know, we talked about that first startup having $12 million. Well, you know, part of that was because computing resources were so expensive. In that first startup, after we raised that $10.5 million, we needed to buy a storage system. And initially, the storage system that we were speccing out had come back to be quoted to us for $1 million. We ended up getting an IBM system for $250,000. So it was a lot more affordable. That was for 2 terabytes of storage. Okay. 2 terabytes of storage. Like, that's how much storage you get in a laptop nowadays, right?
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, out of my realm of expertise. So yeah. I don't know what that translates to.
2 terabytes you can buy for like $150 to $200 now.
Wow.
Hard drive, yeah.
Okay.
A thousand times more expensive
20 years
so
ago.
So if you think about that and how much the cost of computing has dropped just in this short span of time, like, I could do that same first company again, and I could probably do it in $1.5 million to $2 million maybe. And almost all that money would be people cost and not stuff costs. We had a server room, and I've racked servers, and I've done all that stuff. There's no reason to do any of that stuff now. So I think the cost of computing coming down so low is opening up all kinds of new industries. I mean, we've seen it in like genetic testing and things like that. I mean, it's amazing what is coming because of all of this computing power that is available and available instantly, essentially. Right. So I'm excited about that. I think there's new things with vehicles and whatnot. Here at Prototype Prime, we've got an advanced and autonomous vehicle test track that we're building in partnership with the city. And we're building an accelerator to focus on those startups and corporates. I think there's going to be amazing things in the mobility space, in the health space. I'm pretty excited about all of it.
Awesome. Well, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at Sanjay. That's S-A-N-J-A-Y. I've got a website, sanjayparekh.com, okay, which is sorely out of date. And hopefully one day, hopefully by the time this podcast is up, we'll be updated. But
yeah, we need to hold you to that, listeners. Hold Sanjay to that, because we've been saying that on every episode of Tech Talk Y'all, which is Sanjay's other podcast.
Yeah. Not just mine, yours as well.
Well, I edit both of it. I'm not the comedy part. I'm the behind the scenes part of that. Two rapid fire questions for you to wrap up. What is your favorite book?
Ooh, favorite book. There's a lot of favorite books out there. Probably, you know, my most favorite author is Isaac Asimov.
Okay.
I'm disappointed I never got to meet him in real life. He passed away some years ago. His Foundation series is probably one of the best written series. It started out as a trilogy, and I think it's actually 5-6 books now, something like that. But it's a really great, if you're into sci-fi, it is a really great series. I love it. I don't mind reading that one over and over again.
If you could, and you regretted that you weren't able to meet him, if you could grab a beer with anyone currently in the world, Ooh. Who would you pick?
You know, who I'd probably want to hang out with for a bit, might be a little cliche-ish, would be Bill Gates.
Okay, yeah.
I think he's doing such fascinating work. He's got an interesting career, right? I mean, dropped out of school, started up Microsoft, really only had one job ever, running Microsoft. But I think his post-Microsoft time has been so fascinating. I think he's done... It's funny because he was vilified so much, especially near the end of his Microsoft days, because the monopolistic things that they were doing and all that. And to see the time afterwards, I think more than redeems anything that he might have done that was bad during those Microsoft days. And I think in retrospect now, I don't even know that I would say that the time was, I mean, they were acting like a company, like they try to protect their markets and stuff. And this may be different now, me as a founder versus when I was younger and seeing all this. But I appreciate a lot of the advancements of technology that they've done. And I think after he has left, the company has done even more amazing things. But the stuff that he's doing and the things, how deep of a dive he does in the areas that they invest in, the fact that he doesn't just write checks, he like reads the research and understands it and really gets in there deeply before deciding to go all in an area is fascinating. And I appreciate that approach. And I appreciate, for all of us, for all of humanity, if more people were like that, I think the world would be a better place.
What a good note to end on. We'll be back next Friday for another episode of Startup Days.